This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, continued fallout and repercussions from the U.S.-targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani on January 3rd. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. At first, the Trump administration alleged that there was an imminent threat posed by General Soleimani, who as commander of the elite Quds force in Iran, was the architect of many Shiite pro-Iranian proxy militia groups across the region known as the Axis of Resistance. President Trump even alleged that Soleimani was about to attack four U.S. embassies, a piece of information about which Defense Secretary Mark Esper seemed unaware. However, many Democratic lawmakers and a number of Republicans have questioned the administration's claims about the immediacy of the threat and the targets, and charged that it has failed to provide full and accurate information about an action that brought the United States and Iran to the brink of war. U.S. President Donald Trump added to the controversy over his administration's justification for the killing of the Iranian general, along with a senior commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, saying Monday, January 13th, that, quote, it doesn't really matter because of his horrible past. But in fact, it really does matter, and when the most powerful country in the world decides to take out a member of the Iranian government, no matter how heinous his malign activities, it's important to have a straight story. Many Pentagon officials were shocked that the president chose what they considered the most extreme option, and some intelligence officials worried that the possible long-term ramifications were not adequately considered, particularly if the action on Iraqi soil prompted Iraq to ask for the departure of American forces. And that seems to be exactly what may happen, based on a vote in the Iraqi parliament to do just that. No doubt tensions had been escalating between Iran and the United States since President Trump pulled out of an Obama-era nuclear deal and then spiked shortly before the airstrike. President Trump consistently decried the 2015 nuclear deal, negotiated by six world powers, meant to constrain Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Instead, Mr. Trump chose a so-called maximum pressure campaign and reintroduced punishing unilateral sanctions on the regime. The strikes that killed Soleimani were carried out after the death of a U.S. contractor and a rocket attack against a military base in Kirkuk, Iraq, that the United States blamed on Kataib Hezbollah, an Iran-backed militia. Iran responded to Soleimani's death by launching missile strikes at two bases hosting U.S. forces in Iraq. No casualties have been reported. In an address to the nation after that, President Trump announced that new sanctions would be imposed on Tehran. Well, joining us to analyze the implications of the recent killing of General Soleimani for Iran, Iraq, and the region are two distinguished analysts. Brian Katulis is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank here in Washington. His work focuses on U.S. national security strategy and counterterrorism policy. He's also the co-editor, along with Michael Rubin, of the recently published book, Seven Pillars, What Really Causes Instability in the Middle East. And Kaylee Thomas, she's a research associate for the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, that's CNAS, that's a policy group based here in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
First to you, Brian Katulis, about this, the shifting rationales for the targeted killing of Soleimani by the U.S. administration. Why do you think it's important to communicate accurately and truthfully, not only to members of Congress of both parties, but also to the American public, about this particular threat that would lead the United States to take out a person, notwithstanding his heinous actions over the decades, who is considered number two in command in the Iranian regime?
For two reasons. First, it's a very risky action that brought us to the brink of war. And if America is going to go into a full-fledged military conflict, we need to know the rationale behind this strike. And then second, there's an actual legal reason for domestic U.S. law and international law. This question of whether there was an attack that was imminent on the United States is vital, because if there's no imminence, and it doesn't seem like, it's not clear actually what the case was. Secretary of State Pompeo just a few days ago said it was about deterrence and restoring deterrence, which is a different storyline than from an attack being imminent on the United States. If there was an imminent plot, they should share that at least with some of the members of Congress, if they can't with the broader public because of sources and methods and how the information was collected. But it's for those two reasons, that this is, in essence, an act of war that could have led to a broader conflict. And then second, there's just a legal rationale for whether our military can operate in this way.
I'd like to get your take on that, Kaylee Thomas, why it's important for the administration to have a rationale that does meet expectations of members of Congress and the American public, and why it's important that it be strong and coherent as opposed to shifting.
It definitely plays into kind of the larger lack of calibration of the administration's Iran policy. I mean, I think even without an imminent threat, the administration probably could have made some most likely very convoluted legal justification for taking out Soleimani. But the reporting that you alluded to in the introduction is that this was a seemingly impulsive, extreme option taken by the president. And that's really kind of the answers that Congress is looking for, as that's become a deteriorating relationship between the executive branch and Congress, especially on U.S. strategy towards Iran. So moving forward, if you have a president that's doing things impulsively in this space, and I think his impulse was to try to establish deterrent against Iran, I would argue that that strike does not do this and brought with it more consequences than any sort of benefit. But I think those are the answers that Congress is looking for, are important to give because it signals both internally and to partners and allies across the world, where is the administration trying to go with all of this?
And I didn't mention, but I'd like to now, something that Mr. Trump said, that he can't trust Democrats with national security. And that's rather disconcerting to hear that from the commander-in-chief, because, again, it kind of plays into stereotypes, and it's not helpful, and it makes people question whether or not this was politically motivated. That is, the killing of Soleimani, something we heard many people say, maybe it has something to do with distraction from his impeachment trial.
I think the more political and partisan that the Iran issue becomes, I think also kind of threatens the chance that Trump could kind of create a new deal that is lasting. I mean, really, if you look at it, the reason Trump was so against the 2015 nuclear deal was because it was the deal that Obama got. And so that's been the partisan narrative from the beginning. He's just deepening that, I think, on the intel issue and then on Iran writ large. And so that kind of brings up a lot of questions about whether we could reach a bipartisan consensus if a new deal were to actually be on the table.
Well, back to you, Brian Katulis, on this question of deterrence. Does it restore deterrence, the fact that Soleimani is gone? How do you see it?
Quite likely not. Iran, as we know, for decades has built a network of terrorist proxies and partners, not only in the region, but around the world. And it's a quite dangerous network. It also has incredible cyber capabilities, which it's used. And it's an important issue that we need to keep watch on and vigilant, because I think Iran is quite calibrated in how it uses force. It's not likely to do something that would draw America into a conventional battle, because they know that their military is so much weaker compared to our military force, plus the firepower that's been arrayed across the Gulf from them for years now. So I think quite likely it's in this what we call an asymmetric space, where Iran will likely choose a time and a place to hit the United States or some of its partners. Could be assassinations of officials, kind for kind. We've seen this in the tit for tat in the fights between Israel and Hezbollah along Israel's northern border. But I suspect something's coming, in part because Iran's leaders tell us it's coming, and they've said it repeatedly. Although there was this ballistic missile strike on the Iraqi base where U.S. forces were housed in Iraq, I don't think that's the end of it, and I think more likely we're going to see an asymmetric response.
How do you see it, Kaylee? This is not the end of it, the recent attack with ballistic missiles on the Iraqi base where U.S. forces were stationed.
Yeah, I think that was the immediate, highly visible response. I think what Brian is laying out is the more, deniable, spectacular response that is actually intended to inflict pain and increase Iran's leverage on the United States. I mean, when you speak about whether or not this restored deterrence at the height of U.S. troop presence in the region, I mean, anywhere from 2004 to 2008, 2011, when there was 150,000 to 200,000 troops surrounding Iran, east to west, they were still attacking, American lives. I mean, that's when people say Soleimani has the blood of, hundreds of American lives on his hands. It was during that era. So this idea that one simple strike or even the deployment of, 20,000 troops to the region over the course of the last year is going to prevent Iran from engaging in the asymmetric capabilities that it's invested in heavily over the last decade, I think is quite naive.
And back to you, Brian Katulis, because notwithstanding the blood on Soleimani's hands and notwithstanding the fact that no one is really mourning his death, obviously, that is here at least in the United States. But is he indispensable, or how do you see his successor and the fact that he has basically established these proxy militias in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria? Why should we believe that his death now will somehow sabotage or lessen their influence in the region?
I don't think that we should believe that. I think that he was operating in a government that actually has a quite coherent command structure. And they pretty rapidly moved to a transition. And I don't for a moment think that they're going to let up, particularly as President Trump has moved into this maximum pressure strategy that is inflicting economic damage on the regime and on the people of Iran. And there's elevated rhetoric. And Iran historically has just replied. And unlike terrorist networks, which I think are a bit more dependent on who's leading them and personality driven, this is more or less a person that I think can be replaced. He certainly had his unique qualities, and he was also known by the media and tweeted his way onto the battlefield. But I don't think for a moment that he's irreplaceable, and he's been replaced already. I think what we'll see in the next few months will be the test of whether his departure from the scene was really such a blow for the Iranian regime and its regional activities. I'm skeptical that it will actually set back those activities.
And to you, Kaylee Thomas, I'd like to get your view. And again, in no way do we want to underestimate the amount of blood on Soleimani's hands. So many Americans were killed. And for that reason, I'm sure it's satisfying to many that he is gone from this earth. On the other hand, he, that is Soleimani, did considerable damage already in these last decades. Do you think that there's any reason to believe that the Iranian regime under his successor will be any less committed to spreading Iran's influence, its Shia influence, particularly in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen and elsewhere?
No, I think, there are two important points to highlight. One is that Iran's strategy of building proxy networks and really just partnerships and alliances to kind of extend the front of its influence throughout the region predated Soleimani's leadership. And then second, Soleimani was, I think, important in his role in the sense that he was a strategist and did seek to understand, what the U.S. would do. And that's in part why he was able to kind of exact so much damage and cause the loss of so much life without causing a U.S. response. But moving forward, you may actually see less restraint in the proxy networks. That could be one consequence, is actually that you have someone who was well-calibrated, who was part of that calibrated Iranian foreign policy strategy, and that may fall apart. So we may see further escalation in that regard.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Brian Katulis, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Kaylee Thomas, from whom you just heard. She's a research associate for the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And we're examining the factors that led to the U.S. targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the long-term fallout from this action on Iraqi soil. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Asif Sumru from Hyderabad, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Brian Katulis. I want to continue on our conversation with respect to the fact that rather than lessen tensions in the Middle East and weaken Iran's hand in the region, that unfortunately the killing of Soleimani may in fact heighten tensions,
right,
and even strengthen Iran's hand.
Right.
Witness the fact that Iraq now is asking for the departure of U.S. troops. There was a vote in Parliament. We don't know where that stands, but there is now a desire for the United States to leave, and I don't know how this can be seen as positive for the United States insofar as troops were there to help fight ISIS, which continues to be a threat, even if the caliphate's so-called territory has been eliminated. How do you see the impact on U.S.-Iraq relations, our ally?
So first with Iraq, there was a vote just days after the strike in the parliament, but it was mostly a vote by the Shia parties. A lot of the Sunni and Kurdish voices were not part of that. The measure itself was symbolic. I do think there's very real anger and tension here. The current leaders are still demanding at least a conversation with the United States about the presence. So the story's not over yet, but it's not as clear right now. I think Iraqis are trying to measure up what it is they need for their security inside of their own country and how much the U.S. supports that versus the increased risk of the Trump administration's actions in this strike, as well as statements that I think President Trump has said for quite some time now that U.S. forces are just in Iraq to watch Iran. It was one statement President Trump made, which if you're an Iraqi citizen or leader, you'll find this deeply offensive. So I think this storyline will probably be one that we're debating for weeks, if not months on end, because the Iraqis still are very dependent on U.S. training and security assistance. And the troop presence back here in the United States is not as controversial as it was, say, 12 years ago, when there were so many people coming home every month in body bags, when the costs were so high. A lot of the talk you see in our politics back here is a little thin and cheap because most Americans don't really care. They're not as focused as it was relative to 10 or 12 years ago. So we'll see. One other thing I'd say is that among some of Iraq's neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, UAE, and some of the Gulf countries, which I talk to regularly, and I was in the region at the end of November after there were these strikes in Saudi Arabia on a major oil facility. What was interesting to me was talking to the leaders of Saudi Arabia and UAE and how they had opened up their own channels to de-escalate tensions with Iran. This, again, preceded the Soleimani strike. It was in the October-November space. And there was this moment where I think a lot of the countries in the region, many of whom are very skeptical of Iran and feel threatened by them, had this wake-up call and said, wait a second, maybe we need to protect our own interests by having more channels and more conversations across the Gulf with Iran, because we need to avoid an all-out war. That's the last thing I think a lot of countries, including Iraq, want in the region.
That's very interesting that you say that, because I read those reports and I wasn't sure about the basis for them. So back to you, Kaylee Thomas, with respect to the impact of this strike and the escalation of tensions between Iran and the United States on U.S.-Iraqi relations. The fact that the United States struck Soleimani, took him out on Iraqi soil, was seen as an attack on Iraq's sovereignty, as with previous strikes by the United States that led to this escalation. Why do you think it's dangerous that the United States weaken its ties with Iraq and lead to the possible precipitous withdrawal of U.S. troops?
First and foremost, and the overarching picture, is it just lends to this narrative of deteriorating U.S. credibility in the region. So now we have our Gulf partners questioning whether or not the United States will come to their defense, because the U.S. response after the September attacks on Saudi oil infrastructure were much more lackluster than the escalation we've seen over the past 2 weeks after the death of an American contractor. So you can kind of see Trump's priorities there. And then I think, you know, in the context of counter ISIS, I mean, you're showing that this was almost going to be a model for future engagement in the region. This idea that, you know, we put some troops on the ground, we're not a completely obtrusive presence, but that we're training, we're building long lasting partnerships, you know, we're imparting increased capacity. And not only do you now have potentially a vacuum of kind of troop presence in that region where ISIS could reemerge, you're also saying to other countries and signaling around the Middle East, hey, when we say we're going to be there, we're going to help you out, obviously, maybe we have some other priorities and we're going to stab you in the back in the end. And that's not a good narrative to continue.
Exactly. Well, based on your analyses, it seems as if this strike on Soleimani may have many more deleterious consequences than positive ones, notwithstanding, once again, the blood on his hands and the fact that he was such a bad actor. Back to you, Brian Katulis, and let's go back to what many consider the act that precipitated this tit-for-tat, and that's, of course, Trump's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. He was against this deal, as we said earlier, because in part it was negotiated in part by Barack Obama, his predecessor. Notwithstanding its many shortcomings, both the proponents and even detractors said at least it was keeping Iran from progressing its nuclear program. And of course, Mr. Trump also falsely said that the United States gave money to Iran, rewarding it for signing this, which is not true. These were frozen funds they were Iranian assets that were frozen, and then they were returned to Iran. So that's important to rectify that falsehood. But now we're seeing, of course, the European leaders are worried. They're triggering the so-called dispute mechanism over Iran's failure to live up to terms of the nuclear deal, because it's starting to see that they're not getting anywhere. They're not getting anything from remaining in the deal as long as Trump continues this so-called maximum pressure campaign. How do you see things going forward?
Well, look, I think every day you look at Donald Trump's foreign policy overall, and it seems like a daily train wreck. But on his Iran policy, we got here by no accident. This was intentional. The current president signaled this as a candidate, that he was going to pull out of the deal. He was, for the first year or so, still part of it, but his rhetoric indicated that he wanted to tear it up, which he did in terms of the U.S. presence. But the thing that I think has really gotten Iran in a corner have been this sort of economic sanctions and increased pressure on the regime, which is being felt by the government, but then also by the people. And for every action in the Middle East, there's a reaction. And maximum pressure has been met with this calibrated resistance from Iran, where it's been targeted. It's been pushing all sorts of buttons over the last year that have turned up the temperature and made the Middle East more insecure. And as you mentioned a few times, unfortunately, Donald Trump, but then also his opponents here at home, have made this a partisan wedge issue in our politics. And you go to these discussions and people talk about the JCPOA in this Talmudic sort of way, all the details, and we should just rush back to it. And it's mostly disconnected from the new reality that's emerging in the region. And that new reality is a much more riskier environment, where we were just a few minutes away the other night when the Iranians attacked the Iraqi base where U.S. troops were housed. And as the U.S. commander said earlier this week, we could have lost many lives there. And if that was the case, that would have been a full-blown war. So bottom line, and I think I don't see Donald Trump diverting from this pathway. Buckle up. It's going to become even more unpredictable, despite anything that we may talk about here in Washington. Events will be driven on the ground and in the region, and I don't see Trump sort of diverting from the pathway he's on. There is some slight chance that he's looking for some sort of deal. The premise of maximum pressure is to get the Iranians to the table. I think we're further away from that since the Soleimani strike than we've ever been in a long time. And that's why I see that every day there's a prospect at a moment's notice the U.S. is drawn into a very ugly Middle East conflict.
Kaylee, critics say that the administration has a lot of tactics, but no real broad strategy, other than saying that Iran's a bad actor, it can't have a nuclear weapon, it has to come to the table. But the tactics that they're using to bring Iran to the table don't seem to be working. Maximum pressure is prompting Iran to breach the Iran nuclear deal even more, which is why European leaders now are triggering this dispute mechanism over its failure to live up to the terms. How do you see the significance of what the Europeans are doing, and in the fact that the United States doesn't seem to have an overarching strategy going forward?
One thing we even saw recently was the administration now throwing out, oh, well, we're increasing sanctions only until Iran changes its behavior. No further clarification on that. I mean, I guess then you're supposed to look back to Pompeo's 12 points, but we've seen so much confusing messaging from the administration, and that's probably just representative of the lack of cohesion within, and that there is no plan. The disappointing thing is now the Europeans have been relatively sidelined. I mean, what the U.S. unilateral reimposition of sanctions showed is that, you know, we didn't need the multilateral coalition that existed to bring Iran to the table under the JCPOA in terms of exacting pressure. Now the U.S. isn't leveraging that pressure to anything productive, but all the Europeans can do is try to kind of slow the train as it's crashing, you know, and they only have a limited set of tools to do that. I think one is the dispute resolution mechanism. I think they're triggering it now, probably as Iran announced it would no longer abide by those commitments, but before we actually are under the crisis of, oh, Iran has, you know, enriched, you know, uranium to 20% and really acts on those things that would change breakout time drastically. So hopefully they see this as a way to kind of keep Iranian restraint or keep the nuclear program under wraps for months rather than, you know, just a couple weeks.
Well, on that ominous note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Brian Katulis, he's Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Kaylee Thomas, Research Associate for the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another encounter on The Voice of America.